This week's an exciting one. I've got the professor in again, Dr. Mack. How are you, mate?
Well, good, mate. Thank you. Good to be back.
And this is one for the S&C guys out there. We're going to talk about recovery monitoring. Let's get it started.
Let's do it.
Welcome to the Body Science Podcast, bringing you everything you need, want, and should know about health, fitness, nutrition, and training. As always, the information contained in this podcast is for the information purposes only and is not designed to diagnose or be prescriptive to treat, prevent, or manage any injury, disease, or other health-related condition. Today's podcast is brought to you by Whey Ultra, a 100% whey advanced performance protein designed for results. The ultimate in post-workout nutrition, Whey Ultra boasts a 4x whey protein matrix of peptides, isolates, and concentrate, is loaded with BCAAs and EAAs, and is rapidly absorbed for maximum recovery and lean muscle growth. It's enhanced with prebiotics, probiotics, and 5 digestive enzymes, plus is free from soy, gluten, added sugar, artificial flavors, and sweeteners. And every batch is banned substance tested. Everything your body needs for recovery, nothing you don't.
Welcome to the House of Fit, Happy, Healthy with me, Dr. Mack. How are you, mate?
Really well, mate. Thank you. Good to be back in the house.
And you've pulled forward that you want to talk a little about recovery. Like, that's not a sexy word. Everybody wants better recovery, but it's not something that you hear a lot of these days. There's a few recovery centers popping up and a few little cool things happening, but...
Yeah, we thought we'd mix it up, right?
You put it on the front of a protein powder, you can't give it away.
Really?
So, yeah.
Okay, like, well, that's disappointing. But it's a fairly important part of the whole process, right?
Absolutely. It's not a sexy word. So how do we make it sexy? Let's throw some science around it.
Yeah, well, I guess there's a couple of ways we can look at this, and this might be a two-part sort of podcast, but there's one thing around looking at, because my question is always when people talk recovery, I say, well, what are you recovering from? Requirements around how you recover from an ultra marathon to a strength workout are somewhat similar, but there's also some differences that need to be considered. So
let's focus on monitoring today.
Yeah, okay. Yep. So let's talk about the monitoring piece. And so I think there's some good stuff we can look at there, because there's some practices and things that have gone on in the industry for a really long time, strength conditioning wise, that I think we can provide a bit of an overview, and then maybe dig into a bit of the science around what the justification for it is. And for the health and fitness PT sort of fitness instructors of the world, there might be some takeaways in terms of what they might be able to do, because there's some good tech out there. There's lots of various apps and things that people can really integrate into their training, and I think it's a pretty decent place to start.
So for the people out there that aren't S&C coaches, mate, why do we care about recovery?
Well, we should all care about recovery, mate. I mean, it's a really big part of, if you're training clients on a day-to-day basis, we could shift it. I call it, you know, determining preparedness. So when are you, if you're training people on a daily basis, how do you know if they've fully recovered from the previous day, and are they ready to train optimally in a subsequent session? So it's a really big piece around getting the best out of their workouts and ultimately, you know, achieving the outcomes. So, yep. You know, people don't get into this. That's probably a good point around some terminology around under recovery and overtraining. And so, you know, genuine overtraining is pretty rare. I don't see it very often. And there are some, if you don't have a drop in performance, you're not overtrained. And by that I mean, if you can still go to the gym, you can still lift similar weights or, you know, achieve similar performances on a treadmill or whatever it is you're doing, if you're able to do that repeatedly, you can be tired, you can be under recovered, you can, you know, have some sort of fatigue type of characteristics, but you're not overtrained. So yeah. Genuine overtraining is pretty rare, I find, in sort of mainstream health and fitness, but also in strength and conditioning. So I think we can probably square away on, for me, looking at recovery in athletic and general health and fitness, there's a whole range of things that are available to us now in mainstream that even a decade ago weren't. So I think we can probably go through, you know, some of what that looks like in terms of monitoring recovery and looking at hormone profiles, for example, looking at neuromuscular profiles, for example. There's a few things we can do there. We don't need a whole lot of gadgetry. We can look at that. And then we might then dig into literally what, maybe part two, we'll look at what are some of the interventions for that. Yep. So, you know, cryotherapy is popular. Saunas are really popular. Cold water immersion, massage, you know, the pneumatic guns are really popular now for sort of muscle recovery, let's say, you know, form of massage. So that's probably a two-part thing we can look at over the next hour or so. So, I mean, we can go wherever you want with it. In terms of, like, recovery is a big piece, and why it matters is that it's actually a training principle. So recovery should be part of, you know, just as much a part of your training as your cardio or your strength piece or your flexibility piece. All of that should include consideration of recovery. Mm-hmm. And you should monitor structure it, right? Because you want to know, you know, if I'm a PT, a strength conditioning coach, whatever, I'm going to develop a program. I'm going to implement that program. And then I want to have some benchmarks around, is that program effective? Is the person losing weight? Are they losing fat? Are they gaining muscle? Are they getting stronger? Is their, you know, cardiorespiratory fitness improving? All that sort of stuff. So we want to be able to monitor that. And we then want to select appropriate recovery to do a couple of things. One, optimize their training and minimize their risks of injury and things like that. So that's a really important part of it. And where we can, if we get that right, we can accelerate their adaptation so we can get really good results. The knock-on effect there is that it improves their performance, or they get better outcomes. They lose fat, they get fitter, they get bigger, stronger, leaner, whatever. And we can minimize all of the, I guess what we want to have, these non-adaptive responses. So we can reduce the risk of getting unwell, like an upper respiratory tract infection because they're run down, or they're not getting enough sleep, or whatever it might be, or their nutrition's not on point, or they get a soft tissue injury, they tear a muscle, whatever it might be, or they just become psychologically cooked, that, you know, burned out, they get bored, monotony kicks in. And so that shouldn't happen. And that requires some planning. That's the whole impetus of what periodization is as a term, just a fancy term for planning your training and what you're trying to achieve. And you've got to take into account a whole range of variables, things like, you know, biological age, training age as a difference. So training age is really, you can have, and I see this all the time, where you might have, take an 18-year-old male who might have come through a really organized development program, say with an NRL team or an AFL team or whatever, and they might have been exposed to strength training since they were 14.
Okay.
Right. So by the time they get to 18, they've got 4 years of organized training under their belt, versus someone who's 18, interested in putting on some muscle, whatever it might be, and they've got a training age of zero. They walk in the gym and they're not sure what to do. So how you work with those people is going to be remarkably different, because there's a whole range of other variables physiologically going on with that, growth rates and hormonal changes and all that stuff. You know, life gets in the way. So there's training age, there's experience, there's gender, there's some endocrine variations around gender. We've done a whole podcast on testosterone and various hormones like that. There's the environment, literally outside, you know, the temperature, the humidity, the time of day, all of those sorts of things will have an impact on how people's experience of the workout goes, and then how they recover from it after that. And hydration status, what sort of muscle fiber types are recruited in the workout? Is it a plyometric power workout, or is it more of an endurance workout? You know, predominant energy systems, is it more anaerobic? Is it your high intensity interval type stuff, your HIIT training, or is it, let's slow state, turn the legs over? Psychology, you know, some people, there's a level of, people find gyms pretty intimidating as a rule. And, you know, I've spent a career looking at cortisol levels, and some people's cortisol will elevate just walking into a gym. You know, there's a level of anxiety that comes with that just from being in the room. And I've seen people do, I used to look at this when I was working in strength conditioning, when I had, you know, relatively junior players coming into a senior environment. They were really nervous and they would struggle. Yeah. And I would say, hang on a minute, you know, you really shouldn't be struggling in this workout. But cortisol was off the chart. They hadn't, you know, prepared adequately because they were too nervous. They didn't sleep well the night before. So all these things go into play. And then when you're working with teams, or if you're traveling and you're competing, there's, you know, time changes. There's a whole lot of stuff that goes into the mix. So that's kind of why it matters. There's a lot going on.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. One size
very rarely fits all.
No, that's what I was going to say. Like, how do you manage that in a team environment?
Yeah, well, that's a plan, right? That's about pre-screening. That's about, you know, when I'm working with teams, you've got to look at the best bang for your buck, because this is what I say all the time to people. There's a whole lot of different devices and software packages and equipment and apps and all sorts of things in the marketplace. Some of them are relatively cost effective. Some of them cost a lot of money. And I always look, well, what's the most meaningful to this organization for what we're trying to achieve? And it might be, so GPS monitoring, right, has been around for about 15 years now. It's been around for quite some time. You know, when it's an expensive strategy to implement, and it's usually only done at a fairly elite level. It gives you a lot of information around training loads, and I'll circle back on that a little bit later. We can implement these strategies to determine exactly what's going on. So in a gym environment, you can look at, you know, things like total tonnage. You can look at heart rate measures. Yeah, pretty easy now with your Fitbit. There's a lot of devices you can do that. So you've got to identify, you know, what's the most meaningful. So what, minimally invasive, I think things that don't have a big time factor, when you take a lot of time out of someone's day to do testing, they don't always see the worth of that. Cost effective for sure. And then even things that are logistically efficient, trying to fit that into the workout or fit that into a person's day. So in the high performance environment, you know, generally we've done a lot of work around having a systematic approach to when athletes come into a training facility, they'll go through a battery of day-to-day screening type things. And it might be something really simple, like we do groin squeeze, we do, you know, might be internal, external rotation of the shoulder, it might be cuff, might be ankle range. You know, there's a whole lot of simple things that you can implement that just give you little signposts around how that person is placed to do that workout. None of it, and none of this stuff that I'm talking about today, is on its own intended to be a standalone, certainly not diagnostic, and it's certainly not a standalone measure. And this is where, you know, there's an art and there's a science to all of this stuff that we do in strength and conditioning, and we do it in even in mainstream health and fitness. You can't just rely on the art. You can't just go, oh, well, you know, we've done it this way for 20 years and we're going to keep doing it that way. Or, you know, it's not all gut feel, but then it's not all science either. And that's where it's an education piece for particularly new graduates coming out of university. They've got all the science, but they haven't actually coached anybody. So they need to get their hands dirty. They need to get some experience, and they need to, you know, develop some empathy around the individual, because everyone's different. And, you know, you and I do the same workout. We get remarkably different outcomes in terms of our heart rate responses, our endocrine responses, neuromuscular adaptations, that sort of thing. So that's about getting in front of it, doing an adequate amount of screening, and everyone should do that. PTs should do that. If you're going to do a program for people, then you want to have a starting point, a baseline. If you've got a baseline, then you can reflect on that. You can determine, well, yep, you know, we did 8 weeks of HIIT training, and you know, we trained 3 times a week. We did X, Y, and Z, and we got this result. Happy days. Yep. Versus, well, I don't know where we started. We did all this training. This is where we ended up. I'm not really sure whether you got better or not. That's a real common sense type approach. But that also helps you provide a lot of really good feedback to athletes and clients. And I'm all about, you know, the meaningful feedback of that. And particularly in team environments, the feedback has to be timely. It has to be during the session and immediately post-session.
Okay.
Because, you know, when you're going to ask people, and I'll talk about this as we go through, but if you're going to take blood out of people, or you're going to look at their urine for hydration status, or you're going to look at their saliva or make them do a jump test or any of this sort of thing, if they don't see the data or the meaningfulness of that, then they go, oh, you know, Mac, you know, I've been doing this for 6 weeks, mate. Like, is that helping me or not?
Yeah.
You know? So that's important. Yeah. And so the turnaround time on your data is really important. That's why I say to people, you don't need to have 20 tests. You just need to choose what's important for you. And we're talking recovery today. So it's about preparedness. It actually formed, I had a chat, someone I respect greatly, Lynn Jones is a former Olympic weightlifting coach for US and various other countries. And remember, I was very fortunate. I spent some time with him when I was doing an Olympic weightlifting course probably 15 years ago now. And I said to him at the time, you know, if there was one thing that you could determine from your athletes, or there was one test you could do, or if there was one thing that you could do that made a difference, what would it be? And he said, without a doubt, if there was a way that I could identify when someone had recovered from one workout and was ready to train optimally in the next workout, that's the holy grail. So I kind of reflected on that. And that's why I did a PhD on hormones, because that's the answer. You know, we can monitor those, you know, hormones now really quickly. We're down to 10 minutes, 12 wow. minutes in terms of a turnaround time. When I started doing it, you know, I would spend 8 hours in the lab, I petted samples, and do the whole, you know, the reflatron and the whole refractometries type stuff. And it was onerous, and it was expensive. Yep. Whereas now, you know, it's still not cheap, but it's a really quick process to do that. And that's the bodybuilding industry, man. If you're prepping people to get on stage, you know, you want to look at hormone profiles, particularly testosterone, cortisol, amylase, immunoglobulin A, things like that, that are really meaningful for stress profile, but also really meaningful for immune function, so people don't get run down, because they're calorically restricted. They're training a ton. You know, you're in an environment that's pretty well suited to getting run down and getting sick.
Absolutely.
So, you know, if we can do that. And then if we throw in a measure that, you know, determines physical or physiological adaptation. So neuromuscular fatigue has been something that's been looked at a lot in the research. I've done a fair bit of this myself, but there's different types of fatigue. There's central and peripheral. There's high frequency, low frequency fatigue. I'll mention that in a minute. But there's a whole lot of ways we can profile fatigue, and that then gives you information around how you can determine, well, today Greg Young is ready to go, or today Greg Young needs to do 50% of the load, or whatever it might be. So, you know, we've been in that space for a long time.
Are we using these learned recovery background on our athletes on game day?
Yeah. 100%. Yeah. So, well, yeah, you should be. A lot of the information we have that's been developed over the last sort of 10, 15 years has given us a lot of information around what we can expect to see. For example, you know, in the late 2008, 2009, I spent a whole season looking at pre and post game hormone profiles and neuromuscular profiles. That was part of my PhD. And so that didn't take very long at all to determine what were individual patterns. So what happens to them? What sort of profile do they have before a game? So is there some sort of pre-performance anxiety, which we saw a lot? So cortisol will spike, you know, before you run out and things like that. And then as a result of the game, there would be a whole range of variables. So muscle damage markers, things like creatine kinase, which I'll talk about in a minute, but it's an indirect marker of muscle damage. It's not that useful, really. Hormone profiles, and then are they immunosuppressed? And what do we need to do about that? And then particularly with a sport like the NRL or AFL, where you've got back-to-back games, like you might play on a Sunday and then on a Friday night.
Yeah, exactly.
Your turnaround time's really low. And that was one of the works I did, you know, in probably 2010, where from a hormone perspective, you know, it can take, so not so much hormones, but certainly enzymes like creatine kinase, it'll take 5 days to get over a game of NRL.
Okay.
And that doesn't matter whether you do all the best recovery strategies in the world or, well, that helps. So you're in a hole pretty much. So you can struggle with getting back-to-back efforts out of people. But yeah, that's happening most certainly in the high performance. And I look at this, I always look at stuff about the commercial application to it in mainstream health and fitness. And, you know, these are things that you can implement on a day-to-day basis as a personal trainer or a week-to-week basis. Over and above, like challenges are really popular. Everyone's doing a lot of challenges for body comp and that sort of stuff, and that's great. And they're doing different measures, you know, different types of BIA analysis and things like that to track. And that's a really good place to start. But you can also include some neuromuscular measures. So it might be something simple, mate. It might be like a vertical jump, or it might be a mid-thigh pull. There's a ton of stuff we can look at there. But it's all about determining preparedness. Am I recovered? Well, what am I recovering from? And we'll come back and we'll do another podcast on how we can improve that. And then how do I determine that? How am I recovered, under recovered? Am I ready to go or not? And that's, I suppose, leads into, if we talk about some of those strategies. So saliva's probably been my thing for the last 15 years around looking at salivary, not so much diagnostics, but salivary monitoring. And it's really exploded in the last decade or so, where we're able to look at, it's called a lateral flow device, but pretty much what we can do is we can screen hormones now in a really timely manner, so that it gives immediate feedback, so that you can go, well, okay, a person can come into the gym, you can do the hormone analysis. We're actually really close to launching something where they can do it remotely, and then there's an app and all that sort of stuff. When the time comes, I'll tell you all about it.
Remotely, you mean like
on
can do
home,
it myself?
On their phone.
Don't have to send it off.
Yeah, wow. Which is pretty,
it's a game changer.
Cool. Yeah, yeah. But the beauty of these sorts of analysis is they don't require a referral. So we're not doing any blood. So there's nothing invasive. Yep. People don't like blood tests, and there's a time frame around getting those results back and things like that. There's no waiting time for your results. So it's a better picture to be able to just. The other thing, there's no what we call passive drool. Like it used to be.
Passive drool.
Yeah. So it used to be you had to sort of work up a heap of saliva in your mouth and then pretty much spit it into a little cup.
Yep.
You don't have to do that anymore. You can just put it. It's just a little like a polymer thing that goes on your tongue, changes color, and that tells you when there's enough saliva, and then you put it through the analysis and you get a result in under 12 minutes, which is pretty cool. It's a point of care. We call it a POC, or a point of care salivary hormone test. And that's pretty cool. So the limitation is that you can't do every hormone in the world, but we can certainly do cortisol. Talked about cortisol a lot. I talk about cortisol as a really blunt hormone, and that's why I prefer to look at a couple of other things like alpha amylase and salivary IgA. But we've talked about cortisol as a general stress sort of hormone. Testosterone is another one. And for a long time, we've looked at testosterone-cortisol ratio. So cortisol being a catabolic hormone, testosterone being an anabolic hormone. So the ratio of those can determine whether we're in a catabolic state or an anabolic state. Now, if you're in an anabolic state, you're good to go, pretty much. If you're in a catabolic state, well, we need to reflect on that and determine, well, okay, why is that? And that can be something as simple as a conversation. So there's subjective things we can do. So you can literally just ask people how they're going, like literally rate your leg heaviness, rate your sleep quality, you know, that sort of thing. And then there's objective measures that we actually have the person undertake a task, we collect some data, and that goes into a spreadsheet and looks all very pretty. Cortisol, as you know, we've talked about this, it's diurnal, so it has a pattern throughout the day. So where we can, we try and be really consistent with when we do that testing. Just like any form of testing, you want consistency. And that wouldn't matter whether it was a bench press test or a saliva test. You want to have some consistency around how you do that. And so I think we know a lot about cortisol, and anyone who's interested in cortisol, we did a whole podcast on it. Same with testosterone. The two that are probably a little bit new to this conversation are around around what's called IgA, which is an immunoglobulin. Immunoglobulin A, it's the dominant secretory defense mechanism, if you will, that lives in the oral mucosa of your mouth, effectively, mm-hmm. right? So it's your first line of defense against bacteria and viruses and things that come into your system. It's produced by what are called B lymphocytes. They're adjacent to the mucosal cells, which is effectively plasma cells, basically. And so what we know, based on a whole lot of research, is that when you get a drop in your IgA levels, you have an increased risk of upper respiratory tract infection. When you have an elevated level, it means that you're fighting something. You basically got something and we're trying to get over it. So we can use that as a predictor of risk for an individual on a day-to-day basis. And we go, okay, so the question is, well, how much of a drop is a clinical or a significant drop? And that's where, you know, for me, it's about 30%. Mm-hmm. And that's based on 10 years of doing this testing, and I'll publish some research around that. So once we see these changes, we go, okay, well, you're immunocompromised or you're immunosuppressed. So that means I have to modify your training load on a weekly basis, or you're going to end up with a cold and flu. So there is a predictive element to that, and we can be about 48 hours ahead of it. So in really simple terms, we can determine before you even start to feel any symptoms that you're at risk, which is a pretty good piece.
That's gold.
So, yeah, it's gold. And so that's great for travel, performance, particularly when people are in really high training load, pre-comp for anything, but, you know, bodybuilding and things like that. So
what level of sports are using this at the moment?
Well, so because there's a cost factor, right? Yeah. So you're talking about your elite. You're talking about your NRLs, your AFLs, you know, your Olympic level athletes, special forces, teams like that, things like that where it matters, mm-hmm. and there's a budget to spend. But in real terms, you know, from an investment perspective for an individual who's competing, you know, people spend $1,500 on a bikini. So I would say to them, well, okay, over a 15-week preparation, add another $40 or $50 a week, which is, you know, several hundred dollars, yep. but and you'll stay healthy and you'll come in without any risk of getting run down and all this sort of thing.
The best you can be.
Yeah, all that sort of stuff. So that's one of the big ones. The second one is alpha amylase. Now, most people probably associate that with starch breakdown.
Yep.
It's probably pretty commonly there. Not to get too deep in the science, but it's a surrogate sympathetic nervous system mimetic, effectively, which inhibits antigen adhesion into the oral mucosa. So it stops bad things binding with your oral mucosa and stops you getting sick, basically. So it's regulated by the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis, right? And so we've known for a really long time that there's two principal components to stress. And we've talked about cortisol and stress, right? Mm-hmm. Stress, you can have good stress. It's called eustress, yep. right? We want stress. And actually, cold cryotherapy in cold water immersion is a great example of eustress.
Okay.
And so are saunas. So saunas are really popular, and we'll talk about them in another podcast. Yeah. So when it comes to stress, you've got the corticotropin releasing hormone activation of the limbic system, which we talked about before. I know you kind of people's eyes glaze over, but that's the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis mediated. That leads ultimately to a secretion of glucocorticoids, which is cortisol. The second one is activation of what's called the locus coeruleus within the autonomic nervous system. It's a sympathetic branch of the autonomic nervous system, and that releases catecholamines. So catecholamines is adrenaline and noradrenaline. So they're the two main fatigue sort of physiological adaptation we see with stress. What we're trying to overcome, and this is where I talk about cortisol being really blunt. Cortisol is just a global marker of stress, and that stress can be psychological, it can be physical, it might be environmental, it could be anything, right? People's cortisol. So I've always thought, well, hang on a minute, that's not really very valuable to me, because you could have elevated cortisol because you didn't sleep well last night, or you could have elevated cortisol because you're absolutely cooked and you're, you know, one session away from tearing a hamstring. And I'd like to know the difference. So amylase, because it's a surrogate marker of the autonomic nervous system, and particularly the sympathetic nervous system, we can use it to differentiate, not perfectly, but with an element of accuracy, physiological stress from psychological stress. So that to me is really meaningful for everyone, really. You know, if I can say, well, you're stressed because, you know, work's not good or whatever, that's okay. That's a strategy then around managing that, mm-hmm. versus you're physically stressed. That's something I can do something about from a training perspective. So they're the two big ones that we look at with salivary hormones. And like I said, now, you know, we can do that really quickly. Cortisol levels don't correlate with amylase. So that means the amylase and the cortisol are two stress markers that are independent of one another.
Okay.
And that's meaningful in terms of our recovery monitoring and a preparedness perspective. So because the amylase is independent of the HPA axis.
I was just thinking that myself.
Yeah, you were just thinking that. You can look at the changes in those. So I look at the ratio of IgA, which is that immune marker, to my amylase, which is my physiological stress. So if I look at the ratio of those and there's a change of 30% or more,
more,
then I know, okay, this person is physically cooked and they're immunosuppressed.
So do you increase the amount of monitoring you do then in the process of recovery, or do you just continue the same process?
No, I do more. So then it's like, okay, then we do another follow-up. So we might only do this a couple of times a week.
Yep.
Right? Whereas if I see a change, I'll do an immediate, not an immediate, but the next day I'll do it again. And then you'll look more, I suppose, in more detail at other things that you're looking at. So I wouldn't do the hormone testing on its own, provides me with a profile that gives me some information. Now I might, on top of that, I might just go, Greg, how you feel? And you go, I feel good, mate. And so that tells me, okay, well, physically you're in pretty good shape, you know. So versus you might go, man, I'm feeling really lethargic. I don't really feel like training today. So that'll give me some other information that supports, that's the art to the science. And that gives me good information to then modify your program. Now, it doesn't mean go home and have a sleep. That just means, okay, I'm going to change things up. I might drop. And this is where I don't have the answers for everybody. And this is what that comes with experience, is knowing how to change that. Now, if it's physical, then I probably will reduce their load by 50% or something, you know, pretty dramatic to bring about a change. Because I know that if we stay on this road of your current workload, something's going to happen. There's a lot of ways you can do that. There's a lot of software packages that track that. And there's analytics is a big piece to this in terms of your data patterns. So I use a retrospective data pattern recognition process. So I've done a lot of work in the last decade around predictive statistics in performance and injury. And I have an opinion on how worthwhile that is. And my opinion is that it's not where we'd like it to be just yet. So in sports like baseball with Moneyball and all that, different. That's a different sort of scenario. I'm talking about physiological measures of individuals that are highly independent of, or highly individual. So yours versus mine versus the next person in the room. So it's hard to have an ironclad, you know, hang your hat on one measure. You can't really do it. So I look at a data pattern recognition retrospectively. So when we're getting, so in elite sport, for example, we would have 36 data streams on a daily basis that are covering hormone measures, neuromuscular measures, well-being measures, range of movement sort of stuff. We'd have probably 36 data streams every morning on every individual, right? And that gives us a flag based, like a traffic light system. Green means go, yellow means caution, red means there's a flag, I need to do something about this. So that's not diagnostic. That's just, I need to get off my butt, walk down the hallway and ask this player how they feel, which is often the solution to a lot of problems, right? But with data pattern recognition, I'll go, okay, well, player A, let's say you tore your hamstring, right? And I saw certain patterns in your data in the 6 to 10 weeks leading up to that. If the system starts to see the same patterns in another player at 10 weeks, at 8 weeks, at 6 weeks, that gives me a flag. So that's not telling me they're going to tear their hamstring. That's telling me that they're showing the same characteristics that you represented when you tore your hamstring. So what do I do with that? I keep an eye on it. I might modify things and I'll try and have an impact on that. So I might change their loads. I might change their exercise. It might be something as subtle as the order of exercise. It might be an increase in, you know, that might marry up with some hydration measures. It might marry up with hormonal. They might be having bad sleep at the moment. You know, there's a whole range of things. There's a lot of working parts to the whole thing. You know, information's power, no question, right? So if you have this information, you can then form informed decisions and bring about outcomes. If you don't test anything, you got no clue what's going on and you're stuffed. You know, people will tear their... So I think, I don't want to get on the bandwagon, but hamstring injuries, that's a strength and conditioning coach's problem. You know, and I, every time I see one, I wonder why that happened, because a lot of things are preventable and they're one of them.
Yep.
Anyway, I won't get on my high horse. But the other one that gets looked at a lot, and I know I'm doing a little talking, can't get a word
that's
in.
Good,
but the other one's creatine kinase, which is an enzyme. It's an indirect marker of muscle damage, particularly useful in contact sports. But one of the things we get is a repeated bout effect that happens, say, in the NRL. So what I see in the NRL is in the preseason and the first few weeks of the season, I'll see creatine kinase levels off the chart.
Through the roof, yeah.
But within about 3 to 4, maybe 5 weeks, it'll plateau right out. And so the game of NRL brings about less of a damage response over time. And so that's, again, that's being informed around, well, what is the damage? How's it occurring? And am I tracking that? So the thing for me, you know how I said, you know, 5 days to get over a game of NRL, right? That's true from a CK, from a creatine kinase perspective. There's five isoforms of CK, and we're interested in the muscle one. Anyway, why it's not of huge value is because you can still sprint, you can still lift, you can still run, you can still achieve the same outputs from an aerobic and anaerobic perspective.
Yep.
So it's not rate limiting. So it doesn't actually inhibit my performance. It doesn't directly correlate with muscle soreness. So it's an interesting measure, but it's not changing my world.
Okay.
So I don't do it anymore. And it's really expensive. And it's a blood test. Well, it's capillary blood. It's a finger prick. So it can be done remotely. But anyway, the other stuff, I'll really quickly, the other one's around neuromuscular fatigue. So, you know, physical physical preparedness from that perspective. Now, one of the things for coaches, we used to do a lot of vertical jumps and things like that that are maximal. People get really apprehensive around getting individuals to do vertical jumps and maximal tests during the season because there is a risk component that comes with that. Like if you're a strength conditioning coach and you're doing vertical jump testing and someone tears their hamstring doing that in a warm-up.
All fingers pointed.
You're not very happy about that.
Yeah.
So what I'm trying to do is come up with tests that are minimally invasive and give me good bang for my buck. So I worked with a couple of PhD students. Actually, when I was at the Brisbane Lions, we came up with a test, which is a cycling test on the Watt bike. So mm-hmm. Watt bikes are good because Watt, bikes. So what they'll do is they give us left and right power outputs and wattage performance. So you can differentiate whether someone's got a bias towards their left or right. Great for rehab, but also for power outputs. So for monitoring, I can see, well, you know, there's a bias on their right leg or their left leg. And you can look at that. Same that you would do with various accelerometers in running. You can do that with GPS pretty much as well. Anyway, we come up with a protocol that is just a 2 minute easy spin, 6 seconds maximal effort, then another minute easy spin, then another 6 seconds max effort, and that's the job done. Takes no time at all, compares left and right, gives us measures on their power outputs. And over the course of a seat, we published all this. It's all, you know, it's all stood up really well to the science of that. So it's legit. And so when you get into the neuromuscular fatigue, the strength conditioning coaches of the world will be going, okay, yeah, but that's a big can of soup, right? Because a lot of people will look at things like rate of force development, reactive strength index, even time to peak force, time to peak power, concentric, eccentric ratios. There's a ton of stuff you can look at. Commonly with vertical jumps, mid-thigh pulls, bench throws, grip tests, there's a ton of stuff you can do. What I like to do is mine into, well, what type of fatigue is that? So we have peripheral fatigue and central fatigue effectively. So central fatigue is anything that happens at the alpha motor neuron or above. Just run with me on that.
I'm running with you.
A few people will know what that means. It has to do with the way by which an action potential propagates from your brain to the muscle in really simple terms. Peripheral fatigue is anything at the motor neuron end plate or below. So most people know what that means. Not most, but some will know what that means. Anyway, we can differentiate that effectively. Well, that's the holy grail if we can identify how that works. So there's a couple of different mechanisms by which that can happen. Fatigue is effectively just the inability to produce or maintain power output, force output. Simple as that. That's oversimplified, but that'll do. The mechanisms are fairly detailed, but it could be something like an inadequate excitation of motor neurons. It could be the action potential transmission fails somewhere along the axonal branch points. It could be that. It could be a failure of the action potential to get through the synaptic bouton. It could be a failure of the action potential to trigger a like an acetylcholine release at the actual neuromuscular junction, which is one potential variable. Maybe it doesn't get through, the action potential doesn't get through the full length of the sarcolemma, which means it'll fail to invade the transverse tubule. That results in a lack of sarcoplasmic reticulum to release calcium. That will affect the binding profile of troponin and tropomyosin on the actual muscle itself, and it won't generate force. So there's a whole, what I'm saying there is there's a lot of stuff that can go wrong. Or if you can tell me that you can pinpoint which one of those it was, I'd like to talk to you because that would be really helpful. It's impossible to do that really with our current, you know, sort of monitoring strategies. But so we can look at central and peripheral fatigue. Effectively, what happens with central fatigue is that there's a slowing of the motor unit firing rate. And that effectively means that it can't be sustained or repeated with different efforts. And then with your peripheral fatigue, we've got high frequency and low frequency fatigue, effectively. So high frequency fatigue is also called a neuromuscular propagation failure theory. Briefly, it's got an issue between sodium and potassium transmembrane gradients, whereby you don't have enough, well, there's an insufficient sodium potassium pump activation. So what happens there is there's not enough concentration of sodium potassium to actually decrease the action potential. It's called the M wave. Yeah, the M wave, let's call it, won't then propagate through the T tubule. That will then result in that diminished calcium release. Are you still awake? You good?
I'm mate, clear as.
Yeah, good. Anyway, so what that means is a lack of force and power development. Anyway, so low frequency fatigue is known as peripheral failure theory. A little bit different, but ultimately the output is the same. And I won't bore people with that.
So mate, how are you turning this into English for a coach? Like if you're
I'm just using the general terminology of fatigue.
Yeah. I get that, but you've got to walk up to the coach and go, hey, star player is ABC.
He's tired. He's fatigued.
And
he's got a lack of force and power output, such and such a measure. That is combined with he's got a 30% reduction in his alpha amylase salivary IgA ratio. His cortisol's through the roof. Power outputs on his watt bike are down. He's cooked. Okay. We need to do something with him. And he's telling us he's tired.
And are they asking you to go see the doc or are they asking you to do, or are they?
No.
Like, that's a pretty big conversation to have with someone who's obviously focused on coaching a team.
Yeah, well, that's where.
And you're talking about, you know, taking out some of the key assets of game day.
Well, we're not taking them out because it doesn't get to that. And that's the obligation of the strength conditioning coach to get in front of that. This is not game day
So you mentioned like 48 hours earlier, like
But this happens every week,
every season
from the start of pre-season right through. So this is an ongoing profiling that occurs that informs day-to-day coaching, and then ultimately when you get into the season, this is a really streamlined process. So you're able to go, well, okay, this is what I'm saying, mate. You know this information in the pre-season, so you get an understanding of what players can tolerate, and then you can develop their programs off the back of that. Now there'll be times when you know that the team just need to train hard. What I'm all about is we train smart.
Yep.
Everyone trains hard. It's the NRL, mate, or it's the NFL, or it's whatever it is.
Yep.
Everyone on the planet is training hard. We're training smart. We train smart because we've got this information. It can influence our programs, and therefore we don't have the sort of risk profile that we would have if we weren't informed. So that's a daily conversation with the coach on the profile of every individual in the squad. Or he might just want to know, what do I need to know? Yeah, today you need to know that Greg Young, he's turned up at the training center. He's feeling really tight through his calves and his hamstrings. Bought a new mattress. He's got a history of low back injuries. He's got a new pillow, whatever it might be. He moved house yesterday on his own and you know, had a tweak in his back moving his couch, or he bent over to pick up his kid. You know, like it can be anything, right? And so that now manifests itself with our testing you can't even do the test, or your hormones are off the chart, or your power's down, or whatever it might be. Now that will be, okay, so Greg's just going to come out, he's going to do the warm-up, going to see how he feels, and then we'll make a judgment call from there. Or we'll put him through the session and, you know, we might, I would then follow up with him after that session and make sure that in terms of his recovery strategy, which is part two of this thing, is pristine. So it's whatever, it's cryo, it's thermo, it's massage, it's all that. So they're the things that are really important. There's a whole lot of stuff, mate, and I could talk forever on it. Like things like heart rate variability is a big one from our autonomic nervous system monitoring. Heart rate variability, there's a lot of different apps, iFleet, BioForce, Omega Wave, all these sort of things. Heart rate variability I only mention in passing because if you're not doing it every day or every other day, it's pretty useless. Okay. If you're doing it once a week, don't bother. It's looking at, you know, basically, I don't know if you know, but the R-Wave, so you know the QRS complex in an ECG?
Yeah.
Of course you do. Yeah. So the Q-Wave is intraventricular, the septum depolarizes. The R wave is actually depolarization of the main ventricles. And that's a big wave. Anyway, so we can measure the time between R wave. So it's R wave interval. Now, you want to have a high amount of R wave variability, right? That tells me that I'm physically not in a hugely fatigued state. So what happens if you're really fatigued, right?
Yeah.
And your heart rate's 100 beats per minute, you won't have much time between your R wave. And so you'll have low variability. So that tells me you're fatigued. If you're relaxed and calm and all that sort of stuff, you've got a high amount of R wave variability. So in the order of, it's an arbitrary number, but about 70, 75, it tells me you're in a good place. So there's a whole ton of stuff there, mate, with that. And yeah, we're even in a place, I haven't done a lot of it, but you can look at things like, there's things like, it's called heat wave. It's a 3D thermal imaging that, you know, I've seen a number of teams use where a player will just walk into the training center, they'll stand still like in an X-ray machine, like at an airport, and it just takes a thermal image.
Okay.
It tells you where the inflammation is. It's pretty cool. And a whole lot of 3D screening. So there's a whole lot of different ones, you know, Kitman's one or the Kitman, there's Athos, there's a whole ton of them. The other thing, sleep. I mentioned sleep. I know I've been talking forever, but sleep's a big part of the recovery piece and we can monitor that. My philosophy around that is, you know, we can access things like, you know, there's various apps like Bedit, Basis Watches. There's a whole lot of sleep apps. All I want to do is monitor their sleep and identify if there's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
If there's no problem, we don't have to worry about it. But if they've got a genuine sleep issue, then I'm going to send them off to a sleep clinic.
Okay.
I'm going to find out what's going on. And that will then give us a breakdown of the, you know, there's five distinct phases of how you sleep. I won't go into it, but there, you know, there's stage one. Probably the most important from a recovery perspective is stage two and three, which is where stage two it's pretty involved, but it marks the beginning of actual sleep. It's highlighted by what are called theta waves. They're intermingled with this, what's called a K wave complex. And then stage three is actually really important to that. Before you get into stage four, which is more of your deep sleep that people are probably pretty accustomed to. And then stage five is your REM sleep. Now, a lot of people don't even get near that. So what I'm interested in is, are they actually getting into genuine sleep and how deeply and what's the quality of that? And so what's their sleep profile? So you can track that. A lot of people do that with their Fitbits and Bedits and all that. So we're in a good place with that and we can monitor that. Because if you get into a situation where, you know, so sleep deprivation is cumulative, it adds up, right?
Yep.
So if you get into a situation where you're 30 to 36 hours of sleep deprivation over the course of a week or 2 weeks, you'll see like an 11% reduction in cardiovascular output.
11%.
Yeah, so it's pretty huge. Anyway, the last piece is around training load and planning, and I'll be quick. But there's things like the acute chronic workload ratio. So what we can do is we look at the average training load of the current week, and we compare that to the average training load of the previous 3 weeks. Not new, been around since about 1975. But the dogma around that is that higher training loads cause higher injury rate. That's not always the case, right? It's about training smart, not hard. So it's about how quickly you increase training load. So it's called a training paradox, whereby, like, let's say you decide you're going to run a marathon, you told me, right? You're going to run that.
Apparently.
So it's been put out there into social media, so it's happening. So you're going to run the New York Marathon, right? So it must be real. So you're going to run the New York Marathon in 2020. Is this right?
Yep.
Okay. So your marathon prep, if you go from running 2Ks on day one to 20Ks on day two, that's a ridiculous increase in your training load.
Absolutely.
You'll probably get a stress response in your foot or somewhere, and that'll be bad. But if you go from 2Ks to 3Ks to 4Ks to 5Ks to 6Ks, you're going to do okay, right?
Yep.
And it might not even be that fast. So this is looking at this acute chronic workload ratio so that you can, it's actually called the fatigue fitness approach that Bannister came up in 1975. What we know, I'll cut to the chase. If you increase people's training load by about 100 to 150% in a workout, you're going to put them in a high risk scenario.
Okay.
At the other end of the spectrum, if you don't give them enough training stimulus, you're going to increase their risk profile. So I've been in teams that have done I've arrived and worked with organizations that have done no sprint training in their preparation. And they go, well, sprint training is a high risk activity. We're not going to do it. My rebuttal of that is they're going to go out on the weekend and sprint. If we don't give them any sprint training, we're actually hugely increasing their risk profile of injury because they've never sprinted. So this is where we look at how much they have to sprint in a game, and we'll give them volume of sprinting based on that. So if you only sprint 400 meters in 2 hours, then you only have to sprint 400 meters in 2 hours.
Yep.
You know, you don't have to do five friggin' 200 meter back-to-backs and 10 100s and 20 50s.
Yep.
You don't have to do that. Anyway, so that's the other piece to the monitoring. So if you bundle all of that up, it's about monitoring training load, external load and internal load. External load is literally, it's GPS data, it's accelerometers, it's how much volume you do in the gym, it's the intensity and all that sort of stuff. The internal training load is all that stuff I was talking about. The heart rate variability, the hormone profiles, the neuromuscular fatigue profiles, all that sort of stuff. You develop all that, you come up with an individual profile and individual characteristics, and then you have a profile that you can monitor on a day-to-day basis. And that's a recovery 101. Did I talk enough?
Mate, that was impressive.
Well, I don't know, but I tried to cover a lot of ground in 35 minutes, and I don't think I did it. How long did that go for?
About 50 minutes. Well, that anyway, just shows the level of S&C intelligence in the sporting world landscape of Australia. Like, that's an impressive...
Yeah. And that's minimum, mate.
Yeah,
like, that's where everyone should be. And if you're not there, you're missing the mark.
And just tapping on that, recovery, monitoring, and working elite teams now, you have to have a certain qualification to work with the team now?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, I know the NRL's put something in recently.
I know that if you want to work as a sports scientist with teams, you have to be an accredited sports scientist with ESSA in Australia. I'm not sure where the strength conditioning scenario is at the moment. I might have missed the memo. It's a good thing if there is a minimum standard, 100%. Yeah. So I would assume with ASCA, which is the Australian Strength and Conditioning Association, who are the governing body for strength and conditioning in Australia, I would think that would be an incredibly good thing if they're involved in that conversation, that's a good thing.
Perfect.
Cool.
Well, mate, thanks for coming in. That was
awesome.
That was well above my pay grade, but it was recorded. That's all that matters.
That's all that matters. All good. All
thanks,
right.
Mate.
Thanks for having me.
Today's podcast was brought to you by our partners in Fit, Happy and Healthy, ASN, Nutrition Warehouse, DY Discount Vitamins, Fat Burners Only, Evelyn Fay, Mr. Supplement, or find a retailer online at bodyscience.com.au/retailers.